Hello, OT friends, and welcome to the Uncommon OT series. I'm Patricia Modis, and I'm your host, a Filipino-American, native New Yorker, current California transplant, bulldog mama, and an uncommon occupational therapist myself for the past 22 years. On this podcast, you will hear me proudly feature the unique careers of occupational therapy practitioners working in non-traditional and role-emerging practice areas, settings where OT is uncommon. Be inspired as you listen to these up-close conversations and be energized and motivated to follow in these unconventional paths. Happy listening, friends. So today, I am super thrilled to bring to you and to introduce you to four remarkable OTs. Four OTs whom I consider my mentors over the years as a clinician, as a student, right? And as a clinician in different parts of my career, first starting off in OT school, my first job working with Joan, later on moving into, you know, more community-based work and having the opportunity to work with Anne, and then later on also collaborating on many things with Mabel. So I'm super thrilled to bring to you four remarkable OTs who have been so instrumental in my growth as an OT. They are members and founding members of the Mental Health Task Force of NYSOTA, which is the New York State Occupational Therapy Association. The Mental Health Task Force is a NYSOTA community of practice that identifies and promotes occupational therapy practitioners in addressing the psychosocial aspects of occupational engagement, practice settings through education, advocacy, and community. So without further ado, I'd like to present to you Joan Fader, Anne Hiller-Scott, Diane Tufik, and Mabel Martinez-Almonte to tell us more about their work with the Mental Health Task Force. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
An honor to be here.
Likewise.
It's such an honor to have all of you, and I'd love for us to start this episode by having you tell us a little bit about yourselves, a little bit about your background, perhaps some of your favorite occupations, and what brought you to serve as part of the Mental Health Task Force.
This is Anne. I'm probably the grandmother in some ways of this group. This group predated a mental health special interest group that was part of the local OT association. And this goes back 40 years. And at that time, there was already a strong coalition of folks interested in mental health. I initially worked at St. Vincent's, which was at the hub of the community mental health movement. And as I considered future career moves, I knew how committed I was to mental health, and I felt the best way to move that forward was to go into teaching. And I moved on to Downstate. And then one bigger and greater step was to start an OT program at Long Island University. And what I brought with me was not only my commitment to mental health practice, but also to wellness and health promotion, and a sense of inclusion for the broad spectrum of diverse people that we serve. Thank you.
Incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Trying to follow in Anne's footsteps, which may not be that easy. I'm Joan Fader. And I have a very long career, but it's very clearly as an administrator, as a manager in designing programs. And I had kind of a fortunate luck in starting my career way back when with Susan B. Fine, who was very well known in the field, a follower of Gail Fidler. So it's kind of cool was what I was trained to do was to really work in this type of model. And I entered a teaching hospital, which is Cornell Medical Center. So very involved with the kind of the training of residents, social workers, occupational therapists. So my whole career was teaching, but not in an academic, even though I did do adjunct work. But I was able to kind of ride the changes of a more formal setting, a medical model, but always having a free rein, always having a free rein to do what I felt was correct for our patients. So we were patient-centered way before the hospital uses that now. If you Google right now, New York Presbyterian Hospital, the first word they use is patient-centered. But yes, this was something we were using 40 years ago. And always under the belief that the patient is more than their illness. So where the Mental Health Task Force has been kind of my lifeline is that I worked with all sorts of professionals and, you know, going down rabbit holes and kind of forgetting maybe, am I an occupational therapist? But I always was, but it really got reinforced when I was involved with this, with the kind of the formulating and beginning the Mental Health Task Force. So it has been part of my life as much as working in a teaching hospital.
Yes, I very much, that resonates with me so much, Joan. For our listeners out there, I want to share that Joan and I had the opportunity to work together. Joan was my supervisor when I worked at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and I worked those settings that she described and really, you know, admired the administration and the sort of leadership that she's provided for us sort of younger OTs who were just coming into the field, right?
Yep. And Patricia, you were a godsend. We loved having Patricia around, but I know that's not what this talk is about.
It's okay. We can throw some of those in there.
Just a little digression. Always a beauty, and I'm sure we'll have more chance to talk about the experience of, you know, the work, but always yes, the beauty of working with someone who totally is aligned with your own beliefs and your own thoughts and kind yes, of can take what you're formulating and run with it, yes, which is also what our Mental Health Task Force has been like. And we'll get more and more to that. But it's that concept of having an idea and then a group of people run with it.
Yes.
And I think you and I had that experience, and this group really very much is of the same.
Yes, I can't even think of, you know, I'm nodding away over here because, and so are the others, just because it's so true. I, you know, if you have an idea, bring it to the task force, right? And then, exactly. So Diane, you were going to say something?
Yes, I was going to say that as tribute to Patricia, again, of her out-of-the-box work, you were a student of mine at your college.
Yes,
and
I
was. Watched you go into the profession. And one day, as I was coming to observe your facility, I bemoaned the fact that, you know, students are not like patients. Patients give you instant gratification. And she said, well, Professor Tufik, why don't you come and do what you love to do so much, belly dance. Teach belly dance to my patients, to my consumers. And she allowed me to come and teach.
And from that,
I taught a few other places. And, you know, I was energized and excited. So you did your job to energize me, my dear. And I was very grateful for that. But I've been at OT since 1982. That'll give you some hint as to how old I am. because I was a professional actor 10 years before that. As an OT in mental health, I used my actor's training a lot. And with consumers at Metropolitan Hospital for 9 years and Mount Sinai for 2 years in their partial hospitalization program. After that, for 14 years as fieldwork coordinator at CUNY's OT program at York College. And I retired as associate professor of OT. I love theater and belly dancing.
Thank you so much for sharing that beautiful memory. Oh my gosh, I remember us dancing. What a fun memory.
That was a while ago because it was during the beginning of Shakira, remember?
Yes, it was.
It was
in the early 2000s if we had to really kind of narrow it down.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm probably the baby to the Mental Health Task Force. I was invited by Diane and Anne Scott to present my work with the NAMI East Flatbush chapter and the consumers and the family members to come and present to one of their meetings. And that's what I did. But I'm actually just an OT since 1993, working in an inpatient psychiatric unit that has now since been closed. But Ann Scott was my advisor in the downstate OT program. And we've stayed connected throughout the years. She's been a mentor to me and continued my involvement with the Mental Health Task Force, with Joan, a lot of the meetings there at New York Presbyterian. And I continue to be involved with them now in the advocacy and us trying to promote our change of scope of practice. Yeah.
Yes, thanks for sharing that too, Mabel. I don't know, just because you're such a mental health OT in my eyes, that I feel like you've always been there, right? It shocks me to hear that you weren't part of the task force until, well, you say a baby. What are we saying here, maybe?
I'm the last one to join you.
She's a teenager. She grew quickly. She's a teenager.
But, you know, you all bring such a wealth of valuable knowledge, expertise, just, you know, experiences to this group. I refer every student interested in mental health to our listserv, just because I myself, who's been practicing for a while now, have really benefited so much, right? And again, I talk a lot about, you know, I talk about this group, my podcast a lot, as a group that's been such a resource for me, right? As a group that has really, you know, affirmed some of the things that I've done clinically throughout the years. I've found nothing but support and guidance, right? So I just wish that upon every other mental health OT out there who's floundering around, which can very easily happen, as some of you have mentioned. Right. So I'm thrilled that you're here, and I'm thrilled that you'll get to share, you know, bits and pieces of that, and we'll try to capture as much as we can. So thanks for sharing a little bit about yourselves. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, but I'm going to do the history.
Okay.
I'm one of the co-founders. But you know,
okay.
What you said was important, the support that we got. I mean, we talked to each other. First of all, we started once a month, and then we went out for lunch and for dinner. And, you know,
the Vietnamese restaurants. Remember?
Yes. Thai restaurants.
There's a Thai restaurant, but then it also the Vietnamese restaurant.
Every month. But it was the support. We talked about our children. We talked about them getting married or graduating from high school or having a problem or whatever. And we were supported, and that was what was very important for us in those early days too. And
yes.
Now, because we've been together for 27 years, it started in 1995 when Cheryl came as a clinical advisor and I as a field coordinator. Were members of the Metropolitan OT Education Council. As both mental health OTs, we were complaining about the lack of mental health OTs and mental health fieldwork sites. Somehow we devised a plan to pool our resources of emails and phone numbers and mental health OTs in the greater New York area. We got support from Beth Israel Hospital, and it had a good restaurant nearby. In March of 1995, we called a meeting to see how we could solve this problem. And with the help of the Mental Health Special Interest Group, the District of NYSOTA, we were created. That's 27 years ago. 38 OTs showed up at that first meeting. We didn't even know that there were 38 mental health OTs in New York City. And there you have it. With a core of 8-10 OTs meeting once a month, we lasted those 27 years, and we're still going strong. But, you know, our goals are pretty much the same, promoting and preserving mental health OT as the main objective. We network with peers locally, state, and nationally. We explore new models, We develop alliances with consumers, as Mabel has done. We've monitored and lobbying regulatory agencies and legislation, and that's what we're really working with right now. We've also provided mentoring and collaboration with practitioners and researchers, not to mention the listserv, which was started years ago by Hannah Diamond and now maintained by Joan Fader with over 150 names now, right, Joan?
We're almost 160 as of today.
Oh, my God.
I just
we
got two.
Jobs, important events and issues important to mental health OT. And we've done many initiatives, singularly and collectively, from publications, grants, initiatives, conferences, meetings, both locally, nationally, and internationally. We've been very busy these last 27 years. But the final part I wanted to emphasize was during the pandemic, we've been meeting weekly now on Zoom and have been energized by the addition of several new members, including Mabel, and old regular members, and by the support and direction of NYSOTA's president, Flo Haynes, who just awarded us the NYSOTA's Merit of Practice Award for our work in mental health.
Congrats!
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. We are also included in NYSOTA's website, so we can, you know, go there to see us. And
yes,
we're deeply grateful to NYSOTA for their support and energy in our quest to preserve mental health.
Yes, thanks for that. That was such a great kind of historical timeline of yeah, I felt like I was kind of living through it. I was in the NYSOTA website just today, and I saw all of your lovely photos and the description of the Mental Health Task Force, its mission. So we'll have all of, you know, that listed on our show notes so folks can have a look when they listen to our episode. So thanks for that again, Diane. Is there anything that anyone else wants to add about the history of the task force? What brought you to the task force?
Something while listening to Anne and while listening to you, Patricia and Diane and everyone, we're talking about mental health, and that is the most important, but I just want to put out a pitch. I don't care what specialty you're in, you need support to really sustain your professional identity. And I, when I reflect on my profession and what I have recommended to many students over the decades and now my children, it's you need to have a support also outside of, you know, your work setting, and your friends may not be the ones, especially if it's pursuing professional identity. So I would stress that what this group, I think it's an incredible model for any, you know, professional group. And it's the support and the camaraderie and the common mission that makes a difference. If you want to, you know, really sustain your, I mean, you know, 40 years, I have this group to thank that I was able to really remain as a professional OT. So I think that's just to throw that out, that yes, this is about mental health, but there's something larger. There's something larger about the power of a group, right?
Yes. Right.
And we all
power
know
numbers,
groups, right? We know what the power of what we know about groups. And this is really, you know, definitely a perfect example of a very powerful group.
Yeah. Absolutely. Anybody else want to add anything to that?
You know, you can get from the discussion that there's a lot of interconnections between us. And, you know, to support what Joan just said, it's really 2 degrees of separation. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to know that you have a reference group that you can call upon, and people are literally only a call or an email away to support you.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But it even goes deeper. There has never been any sense of jealousy or any sense of wanting to get somebody, right? You know, when you have that kind of feeling in sometimes in your work situation, it's always been very supportive. And
yes,
really, I credit Anne with helping me get my promotion because she mentored me through the difficult aspect of how to get an academic profile together or portfolio together.
Ah.
You know, so it's just a loving, supportive thing. When do you get that kind of stuff in life? It's when you really cultivate it, and we have cultivated it. People yes. really love each other and respect their work and respect what they've done yes. and are doing.
And just to add to that, when I think about not just as an occupational therapist, but this group, Anne spearheaded the whole idea of me as a young occupational therapist to come back and gave me the opportunity to guest lecture both at Downstate, a mental health class, over at LIU when she started her occupational therapy as a chairperson there. And those were opportunities that actually expand your horizons to mm-hmm. just not to be a practitioner, but also an educator for the up-and-coming OT students. And yes. always the pitch for mental health, because not many occupational therapy students were choosing to go into mental health.
Yes.
And, you know, they would choose pediatrics or physical disabilities, but it was always a beautiful opportunity that I welcomed whenever I had the opportunity that Anne would invite me to come and be a guest lecturer. And even the STEP program, Anne, do you remember even coming to give a pitch to students in the community that were part of a STEP program? What is occupational therapy? Just even the what is it to them, you know, as a health profession for them mm-hmm. to consider going into occupational therapy, not alone just mental health, but what is occupational therapy? And she's the one that actually opened up the doors for me to do that. So I'm very grateful.
Oh, I love all the interconnections. Mm-hmm. You know, Diane mentioned that, you know, she was the field work coordinator while I was at OT school at York College. And, you know, of course, you assigned me to my mental health placement, which I think was just, you know, instrumental in defining and me, you know, forming into the OT that I am today, right? So, again, all these interconnections and our, you know, sort of contributions to each other's growth. I just, yeah, I could kind of getting a little misty-eyed over here because it's, you know, again, seeing four of you on the screen, quite a big deal for me over here on this side of the country.
And if I can throw in another pitch, now that I'm just recalling, Anne Scott was part of, she was an advisor to the inpatient unit, the psychiatric inpatient unit there at SUNY Downstate. And she, together with the director of the inpatient unit, collaborated and they formed a scholarship for the senior OT students that we could apply for. And I had mm-hmm. applied for mental health and physical yes. disabilities. And so I was interviewed and I was the recipient of that scholarship, where I actually got paid to do my level two. I did a work study, and then I got paid for my level two in mental health.
Fantastic.
And I attributed wow. to her. And then that's what started my journey. I stayed there and I got hired there. I didn't have to look for work. My journey in mental health, that was so rewarding.
But you know, we wouldn't let you leave, Mabel.
Patricia, you've become now, you have done that. You've brought us together.
Yes.
You've contributed. You have done brought so many OTs together so that they can see what others can do. That's your contributing to exactly what we wanted to do also. So you're one of us, girl.
Oh my gosh. I think I didn't eat. It was just in my genes. It was just in my OT genes now. And you probably planted that in my head from, you know, many, many years ago without me knowing. So it was just, it just came out naturally, right? But no, it's absolutely my pleasure. And I, you know, there's one thing that I thought about when you're all speaking about the task force and what it, you know, why you're there and what it, you know, what you get out of it, right? And one thing that came to my mind is that for me, it always felt like a place where I was understood. You know, like my work was understood. Everybody knew what I was doing. I didn't have to explain. You just knew. And in fact, you had lots of suggestions on how else I can take it to the next level, because you had that lens, right? So, yeah, the feeling of, you know, we always talk about belonging, right? In occupational therapy, I think, the task force, gave me that sense of belonging, because I felt so understood without even having to utter a word about the work that I was doing.
Right.
So thank you for that. And that's why I'm super thrilled to have you here. But we can go on and on and on and gush about this. But let me try to pull us back into a little bit more focused conversation about the task force. So, and you know, again, a little bit about yourselves too. So we talked about yourselves. We talked about what motivated you to contribute or to collaborate within the task force. Do you want to share a little bit maybe about what inspired you to do this type of work? I know, you know, you have your motivations as far as, you know, joining the task force, but, you know, what motivated you to work in mental health, to devote your practice in mental health, which then leads you to the task force?
You know, I have to say, as an OT student, I enjoyed my physical disabilities field work as much as my mental health field work. Dilemma, where do you work? And at that point, I said, what am I really most interested in? What do I want to study? What do I want to learn more about? And mental health came up. So then it's the luck of the draw. Your first job can be so critical.
So
and where you find yourself on first job.
Yeah.
And I found myself in the right place at the right time. St. Vincent's was sort of at the crossroads of mental health, the heart of Greenwich Village, a very unique community. And it was the beginning of the community mental health movement. And people have mentioned the importance of mentorship. Jennifer Thule was the head of the department. Jennifer came from Britain, and Britain was light years ahead of us in terms of community mental health. Mm-hmm. So we had the encouragement and the challenge to do new things. So I found myself in the community with other folks doing outreach in welfare hotels. I worked with man, that was exciting, a little scary, but exciting.
We could do a whole episode on that one.
Seriously.
Yeah, for sure. He actually wrote a great article about it, but anyway.
We'll reference it.
Although, Anne, I have to interrupt you. You say Britain was ahead of us. I came to this country because Britain was not ahead of us. I have to correct you. In the sense of occupational therapy, which was fascinating. Now they continue to be ahead of us. But in the sense of occupational therapy, it was not yet a degree.
So in terms of education.
Fascinating, yeah. So I had been accepted in England, and then I met Simi Sinkin, who happened to be a rather well-known occupational therapist. And she said, Joan, why are you getting your degree in England? You must come to the United States.
Exactly.
Isn't that interesting?
Because Jennifer did not have a degree recognized in the United States.
Exactly.
And she had to go to NYU and get her degree.
Yeah.
So I just think the value of mentorship and people who promote you to positions of leadership. It was through Jennifer I got involved in the local OT association, then the mental health group. She encouraged me. AOTA had an opportunity to do a workshop on assessment. And man, did the mental health group really get into assessments? We knew ACL up and down, and we were going to convert the whole world to adult health positive levels. So, you know, finding a supportive community and a job that lets you grow yourself is really important.
Yes.
But I agree with Anne. You know, it was a different time when we started. There were a lot more things available, more PHPs, more, you know, community, more than now, because now I think a lot of the partial hospitalizations have closed. There's really not as much as we had the ability. Joan, what do you think?
I think it's a complicated, I don't want to digress too much, but I think it's a complicated answer because on one hand, medication has improved.
Right.
So for many of the patients that we initially saw, they were in treatment for decades. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them don't need that.
Yeah.
So, you know, just thinking of that and the change, a lot of the traditional programs did close. Other things opened up.
Mm-hmm.
But community based treatment has not evolved enough. There's no question.
Right.
There I agree. The evolution of treatment could really improve on a faster scale, I think.
Yes.
Right. I say that OTs need to deinstitutionalize themselves and move into the community.
I agree. I really do. I totally agree.
Ditto. We are hearing, I'm hearing so many stories of OTs branching out into the community and, you know, in very uncommon paths, is right. what I'm calling them. And, you know, it's wonderful. I believe that, you know, through that, we're really going back to our roots. We're really, you know, aligning with, you know, our right. core values, right? We have to make ourselves accessible to everyone out there. And, you know, at least in my experience with, you know, some of these experiences you all know very well, through my work in shelters and through my work and within the nonprofit world, that not everyone has access to a hospital, right? Not everyone wants to be in a hospital. And if right. OTs are only there, then how can anyone benefit from any of the services that we, you know, all the good things that we have to offer, right? So,
right, which does bring us back to the mental health task force, because that is very much what we're trying to look at, is how to review the regulations, how to look at our licensure definition, how to make it more accessible. I mean, it is a catch 22 because there are certain things we should be doing, but we're limited by the license. And also regulations and reimbursement.
Yes. So.
Another thing we were doing is also we were trying to promote people, OTs who are doing work in the community. And one of the people that we really tried to promote was Robin Berman. And she is part. If you look at our OT practice, we wrote an article, Anne Scott and I, on her work. And she has now 11 therapists, 11 OTs that she has managed to get in her program right now. And we're trying to highlight her work so that people could see that it is possible to do things like that. It is possible to get more OTs in the community.
We need to find models that really give exposure to students when there are fewer traditional models. And this model came out of two places. The fieldwork coordinators group, who said, we don't have enough community placements, we don't have enough supervisors. And as a group, they said, well, let's pay our faculty to supervise students. That broadens up the number of places we can put students, and then you have the consistency of someone who knew what they learned, what they're coming with, and then encouraging them in a different environment. Mm-hmm. And Robin had paired with Columbia University, originally doing outreach in a men's shelter. And with her model now, she has 50 students a year, and they come from all over the country. And she started LF just being paid as a part-time supervisor. And ultimately they said, wow, this could really work for us. They hired her, and now we've got 11 OTs and 50. Imagine the impact of 50 OT students. And imagine the impact on the students to have that richer fieldwork. Perfect, wonderful.
Right, and the collaboration of a university with community-based is, we think, a very exciting model, which we as the Mental Health Task Force hope to encourage and find maybe more ways to see that happen.
Yes. Also, Joan has some wonderful stuff going on. You have some wonderful stuff happening in your program. The photography group is just...
Oh, right, so we were also talking, Patricia, you so much are looking into, you know, non kind of traditional OT. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, Diana asked me to speak. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting because I'm in many ways a highly traditional occupational therapist.
Everyone seems to think that about themselves, though.
Well, because I work in a hospital, so you're going to think, well, I'm institutionalized. But here's the interesting thing. So let's not rule out all hospitals. If one can find a hospital where they give you a little bit of a free rein because they have so much respect for the work you do, then maybe you can be in a traditional setting and do very non-traditional things. Because mm-hmm. my God, I did, and I think you know, Patricia, and it got even more non-traditional after you left, because I was trying to figure out how to work in a very formulary, highly, highly regulated setting, yes. but be patient-centered. So what that means is patients would approach me and say, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And I'd say, well, let's sit down. Let's talk about it. What are you really talking about? And there, the first example, I think you were still there, was yoga. Patients said, you know, I hear it's really good for my mental health. How can we provide that? And I found a way. And for 20 years, I had a yoga instructor, volunteer, a retired man who was with us to the end. Providing. So there's a really good example. It's really traditional. It's not reimbursable. Mm-hmm. The hospital will not hire, but I found a highly motivated person who believed in the principle and worked with me, the occupational therapist. I could break down the group. I could give him the clinical. And I was incredibly successful. And then what became even more successful was this idea I had as an occupational therapist to look for really meaningful activities for our patients. And I had a patient who presented his street photography, mm-hmm. when he was exiting from the program. It was his gift to the community to show his work. And I was blown away. It was about all the parades in New York City. Never seen anything so beautiful. Hmm. And after he left our program, a good year after, I said, would you come and talk with me about the art of seeing? And he totally understood what I was talking about. Art of seeing is very much based on a philosopher called John Berger, a British guy. And this guy was from Wales, so he knew everything I was talking about. But we collaborated for a decade almost together. And it was this great example of an occupational therapist providing the professional skill part, but working mm-hmm. with someone who was a peer and also a highly professional street photographer. And we had incredible, I mean, it was standing room only every week. It was, and he came and spoke also to the mental health task force, I remember yes. at one point. But a very good example, I think, of making something happen when it yes. isn't really part of the regulation, not part of the hospital, and not really serious treatment based in the eyes of regulators, but in the eyes of the patients, yes, many of them told me it was the most important part of their week. Oh, so I think that's such a good example of, you know, thinking outside of the box and really providing. And it does lead to the final, I think, one of the most successful, which is many years ago, I had a patient who left us, but really wanted to work using his lived experience. And this was before the training was being provided. And we helped him find the training to become a peer specialist. And then I brought him back as an intern and I developed a whole internship for peer training and really had occupational therapists work with the peers. And it was extremely successful. We did it for years. We designed job descriptions. We tried to get it through HR as a position. And it didn't happen during my career, but it is now happening. They now have two peer specialists working wow. at New York Presbyterian.
Wow. Excellent.
And that is that model of working with peers. And I'm sure Mabel can talk more also with in regards to NAMI is a beautiful fit. We mm-hmm. we really are. We work very well together. And again, it's our expertise, but understanding patients' needs, I think, from their strength base that really work very well. And so we yes. had great, great success with our peers.
Thanks for highlighting, you know, some of these just different models out there that OTs are currently involved with, right? I'm very familiar with Robin's program. I'm proud to say I was one of those 11 OTs for many years, working in, you know, two of their shelters in Brooklyn. I'm speechless when it comes to my experiences. I'm yet to do an episode. I'm waiting for Robin to, you know, find a moment to chat with me, but I've asked her 100 times. I'm kidding. But, you know, I want to do a co-episode with her because I have not yet put into words my experiences there, right? I was there for 5 years, so wild and rich, and my growth as an OT, you know, exponentially through the roof. So it's still wrapped in my head, and I'm waiting for my Robin episode to kind of unpack some of that stuff. I think there's plenty of other things to talk about anyway beforehand. But again, these amazing models that are out there, right? Thanks for highlighting them, Joan, because I think it's important for us to talk about them, bring them to the surface, again, see that this is possible. The internship and the collaborative relationship that Project Renewal had with Columbia University was just wow. I, you know, and every student that came through those doors really became a richer occupational therapist afterwards, in my opinion. So, such a great experience. You know, for me as an OT, also being able to, you know, teach from that perspective, right? You know, being the field work educator, that was rich for me, you know, helping students sort of understand those settings, understand how to relate to the clients, just took my OT skills really to another, to a different level, because I had to sort of maintain myself, but then I also had to inform, I had to educate, I had to, you know, be very pro in the process, right? So yeah, again, really great experiences. That's why my thoughts are a bit disorganized, because I still have to kind of weave them in together. But anywho, this might be a really good segue into just, you know, some highs and lows, right? And, you know, you can take this in any direction that you'd like, right? Any lows that you may have had throughout the years concerning your, you know, mental health careers or being part of the task force, and then some recent successes, perhaps. I know, Diane, you mentioned a couple in the beginning.
Well, yeah, I have a wonderful one that was really scary and also very rewarding. And the mental health task force helped us sort of devise a plan, and I'll tell you what this was. It was working with a court case. In 2003, persons with mental illness were denied the half fare program on buses and subways. Yeah. Those with qualifying physical disabilities were accepted. In 1993, a woman with severe persistent mental illness applied for the half fare program, and with a psychiatrist diagnosis was denied the program by the MTA. Okay, finally in 2001, the case was ready to be heard by the New York State Division of Human Rights on the basis of discrimination. The Staten Island Alliance of the Mentally Ill enlisted the help of a really prestigious law firm working pro bono. They called NYSOTA requesting an OT to evaluate a woman for transportation disability. Richard Sable, who was then the co-chair of the district, called me as the co-chair of the mental health special interest group. And together we performed a 5-hour assessment, which included making lunch, riding a subway and the Staten Island Ferry, as well as performing the Allen cognitive levels and the assessment of motor and process skills, the AMP. Now, the mental health task force was part of it. They agreed on these assessments. We collaborated, we talked about it, and we agreed on this kind of assessment, which was really incredible. And all of that correlated a disability, as well as her problems with making a lunch. She had problems with riding the subway alone. And then we testified in front of a judge in a court of law, and her case was won. We were elated.
Congrats.
Yeah, it was great.
Amazing.
It was amazing. We were elated that this 10-year battle was won and the OT was vindicated. This courageous woman really challenged, you know, the court. The experience was very rewarding, fulfilling, but very scary. It was a very scary situation. I'll tell you one odd and funny little thing that happened to me. I was petrified. I mean, they totally schooled us in how to, you know, how to present ourselves. But I thought we were going to be in a very big court, you know, like on TV. Mm-hmm. No, it's a tiny little room. But the judge was 6 feet away from me, and I was freaked. And my fellow law student there next to me, I said, "Justin, please sit next to me." And the judge went, "Madam, we are in a court of law. Please behave yourself." And I went, "Oh my God." But you know what? That pulled me in. I was no longer frightened. I just did my job.
Yes.
It was too much. It really was. But we were really proud of our work. It's really wonderful.
So that was great work.
The wonderful thing about that is it really opened the door then to recognize mental illness as a bona fide disability, and people had the right to access to Metro cards and, you know, ride the subway like everybody else. So
yes.
that was a profound win for society. And I could segue from that because it's, you know, in terms of advocacy in the community, I think this is a really important place for us to be. When I started at LIU, part of my mission was to reach out into the community, use community service learning, and support people with disability in opportunities for health promotion and wellness. When I got there, there was a faculty member who said, "We've been waiting for you."
Nice.
Yeah, Ellen Nussi and her husband, who were very active in the local Independent Living Association. Independent Living Associations are peer-based organizations whose mission is to support the civil rights of people with disabilities seeking access in the community. So, yes, what an amazing learning experience for me, because I really started to see disability from inside out, not as a professional treating people, but seeing what the folks that were on the board were dealing with. And this led me, when I came to choosing my sabbatical project, to do something to celebrate the disability community. And what I came up with was to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the ADA, a disability film festival and wellness expo. So the films were made by people, for people, about people with disabilities. And these films were awesome.
They were absolutely competitive with commercial
films. And we also gave an award to Major Owens. Major Owens was a congressman who was one of the engineers of the ADA legislation. And it was his vision to combine his experience in civil rights, what was happening with women's rights, and couple the perspective of people with disabilities as a civil rights. So, you know, I think we need to get out of our own pool and join others who have a common interest in advocacy in the broader perspective.
Yes.
I also think that the way we can continue would be Mabel and her work with NAMI.
Yes.
She's done a phenomenal job with that.
Yes. Yeah, so actually, one of the things that I think that just to kind of segue into this was that I actually came into occupational therapy with a disability, having sustained an incomplete spinal cord injury, C5 level, and having received many therapies, one of them occupational therapy and physical therapy, I actually began very inquisitive, very observing of my services, and I began to ask questions. And I remember when, after I left rehab and returned to New York from Florida, I continued occupational therapy services. And one of the, in one of the settings, the OT that I that was assigned to me, she was a graduate from the Downstate OT program. Mm. So she asked questions. Do you think that I could actually pursue a career in occupational therapy? I asked the physical therapist, do you think I can pursue a career in physical therapy? So I got a no from the physical therapist, and his remark was no, because you have a physical disability. And I got a yes from the occupational therapist. She says, you know, there's no reason why you can't go to an open house. And so I did. I went to an open house at Downstate. And that was just the beginning of my career as an occupational therapist. And so the idea of me coming in, I believe, with my own qualification, having a disability, a lived mm-hmm. experience, enabled me to have much more compassion and empathy with people with mental health disabilities. And so as I began to work on the inpatient psychiatric unit, one of the things that I became involved in was being part of family therapy sessions with the social worker. And because we had a very comprehensive interdisciplinary team, whenever they would make decisions and they felt that a patient needed family therapy, and so the family comes in, meets with the social worker, and I began to translate for the Spanish-speaking families, I saw that sometimes they needed psychoeducation on knowing what the illness was, how would it impact the patient. And then I learned that at Kings County, back in 1999, they were having NAMI support groups, but in the continuing day treatment program there with one of the psychologists. And I said to myself, maybe it would be an opportunity at the time for maybe informing the family members and the patients that these meetings do exist. But for them to really follow through and actually go elsewhere would probably be something that they wouldn't follow through on. So then there was a psychiatrist, part of DMHA, that was part of Downstate. He actually got us a room at Downstate, and we were able to form our own chapter at Downstate as a home base. And so then now I come and I'm advocating for the family members and the patients, because we had a privilege system. Patients who actually earned, whether it was through good behavior, whether it was that they were much more stabilized on medication, they would be able to go on a family pass or a privilege off the unit for an hour, 2 hours. So I took that opportunity for them to be able to be introduced to the NAMI meeting. I went myself, so I would be there at the session. And that's how I believe that this is the way that they would actually be able to learn about the illness, but also find community support and psychoeducation for the family members. And as that continued through the years, I became more involved in the NAMI chapter, becoming the vice president, and then finding out about Suzanne White's OT's work with NAMI. So then we started to think, how can psychiatric residents on the unit, as they're doing their training, how can they get involved? So we began to form a coalition between psychiatry residents, medical students, OT students with Suzanne and her OT program, and nursing students, pharmacy students. And we started to create a not only a walk group, a fundraising opportunity for the NAMI Walks yearly walk, but also a metabolic syndrome booth. How can we actually be at the NAMI Walks and provide a medical service where the psychiatric residents can actually participate in that? And that was such a rich experience. And that started in 2008, all the way up to like 2020. So we were like the largest we were like the only one providing a medical service at the walk initially at that time, but it was the most visited booth, and it was just so rewarding up to that point. So not only did we have consumer advocacy, family advocacy, but we also were providing a service at that time. Mm-hmm. So that continued.
Great. Just for our listeners, Mabel, NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and they have a fundraising event yearly called NAMI Walks, and OTs sort of collectively come together and joins the larger walk.
That's what Suzanne created, and I guess Diane can speak a lot more to how Suzanne White, one of her students, actually created a protocol, which
you can go on the resources that I provided for you.
Yes.
And it's an interesting story. Because Suzanne, we were all sitting around. I think Anne was there too, and Mary Donahue was there, and we were talking about a protocol suddenly happened on how to do how to treat metabolic syndrome, which mentally ill people have, because they gain weight and don't do exercise. Mm-hmm. And so a protocol was created. Suzanne took it and ran with it. She put it on a website, got her students from downstate to do stuff, and you will see it. It's still on the OT's Walk with NAMI. And since we started, all schools have started to walk with NAMI. I mean, we all
fantastic.
Started. Yes, it was wonderful. The pandemic happened, but I think things will happen again. But it's on the resources. It's on Suzanne's website.
Okay.
It's a very fascinating story of how it was formed. Yeah.
We'll definitely include that. And do you know at what time? Is it held in May? For some reason,
it's held the first week of May.
May,
on
yes.
a Saturday. This 2020, they had it on a Sunday. Mm. But for many years, it was held on a Saturday. It was always the same weekend as Mother's Day.
Mother's Day, right.
And it would be an all-day event. I mean, climax with the concert, mm-hmm. a lot of programs there represented.
It was fun because we walked across Brooklyn Bridge.
Brooklyn mm-hmm. Bridge. We have a
quite wonderful.
Walk. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now it is a national thing. It's not just New York City, right? And that's on different dates throughout the country.
Got it. So thanks for adding that, the specifics on that. We're definitely going to include some of that on our show notes. Any other challenges or successes that you'd like to add?
Patricia, one of my personal biggest challenges did involve you, in the sense that here was a remarkable program. It was called an intensive psych rehab program, and incredible outcome, fantastic reviews. Everything was aligned, and then New York State decided to reformulate treatment, outpatient treatments, and literally from one day to the next, I was advised to shut down my program. Oh. And if we have a low, that is a low, because that program was one of my babies, and it was so successful and rewarding. I remember very clearly when they told me, looking at the senior VP of the hospital, said, "Why don't you lay me off?
Yeah.
And please keep Patricia." I do remember that, because Patricia was an occupational therapist and there were positions on the inpatient. I thought, whatever. And I was like, she's new in the field. And I do remember them saying, "Joan, what are you talking about?" And I'm like, well, I'm thinking of my staff, and I think my staff should stay. And sadly, that did not happen. I think, though, I was able to tell you about Hannah's positions. I felt a little good.
Yes.
Trisha did go on to a phenomenal job afterwards, I think.
Which I think is part of, you know, part of that, right? I think that that was one kind of, when you look at the, I know, sort of the silver lining, right? Yes,
so.
It was a wonderful program. I had a great experience. I probably wouldn't have left if it hadn't closed.
You would have grown with us, right?
Yes, but then it wouldn't have opened me up to really embark upon my, you know, the bulk, the rest of my career since then has really been working in community mental health. Although our programs are very community-based, this really allowed for me go out into the community. It was an important leap, and it had to happen, you know, I guess it had to happen that way, because otherwise I don't know if I would have just left, right?
Exactly. Now, the other low point, and we can, you know, shift to this, which is our task force was dwindling a little bit because we were part of the Metropolitan, right? We were the special interest group, and that kind of disbanded. That disappeared. We all sat on committees there, but then somehow that disbanded, but we were still around, right? This mental health, and we just called ourselves at that point the Mental Health Task, but we were not aligned with New York State Occupational Therapy Association, and we were not really, and there wasn't anything in the Metropolitan. So I think that was a low. I mean, we did continue, we did phenomenal things. I hosted all the meetings at my hospital. We had great speakers. We were doing great work, but we weren't part of kind of a larger picture. And then when and then with the pandemic, that was this opportunity. And I remember we were sitting around as a group and I said, why don't I reach out to the NSOTA? And everyone said, yeah, let's see. I literally got a response within 30 minutes. I'll never forget that. And they said, we would love to talk to all of you and see how we can be of help. And my God, what a great, great thing they've done for us.
Absolutely.
Because we're only growing in leaps and bounds, and it's a very solid state association. So again, it's a great shift for us, I think, at this point.
I'm sorry, we're very much involved in now legislation advocacy and looking at our own practice act here in New York. I mean, we've done enough networking. We've done a lot of networking throughout the state and internationally, locally, nationally, and internationally. But now we need to really pull it together in terms of legislation and advocacy. We can do so much more. OTs can do so much more in so many different other areas.
Yes. Is and that Diane, where?
For me, I just love even being on the meetings, just love all of the different students who are using their capstone projects to enhance mental health awareness.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? And the importance of that being something that OTs were there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that might be the most important thing, Mabel, because if you think of it, I mean, our group, do your math, Patricia. We've been together for decades, right? We're kind of, a lot of us are kind of retired or getting there. So, you know, if you want a group to continue, you need to bring in the young source, the young group. And here we have this, it's incredible. We have all these OT interns who are doing internships at NSOTA, and they're part of our group. And then now we're moving on to the even bigger things. So yes, we need to bring in that next generation. And how else do you do it but through your students?
Yes. And hopefully the word will get out there through this podcast.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we're going to attract like-minded folks.
Absolutely. Right. I want to give out the email.
Okay.
Can we do that now?
Yeah, we can do that.
Oh, okay. So OT Mental Health Task Force at gmail.com. That is our listserv. But also NYSOTA's webpage, www.nysota.org. Click menu, scroll to resources, Mental Health Task Force, and you'll see our mission, values, vision, and our bios. And I just want to say, contact to all of your listeners, contact your state OT association to find out if they have a mental health group, what they are about, when and where they meet. And if you can't find one, start your own.
Mm-hmm.
We'll help you. We'll help you find one or advise how to start one. Mental health needs your help to stay alive. And so advocate, network, and join us in our efforts to preserve mental health in OT.
Thank you so much, Diane. Would any else like to add anything to that? Yeah, I had a feeling.
I just wanted to say that we have interfaced with AOTA, Megan Pudler. She's been extremely helpful in sharing with us what's been happening in OT mental health across the country, at places where people are making advances in terms of getting recognition, getting funding, and this has been absolutely invaluable. Mm-hmm. The other thing is communal OT often has some interesting, you know, shout outs. And there was just a shout out kind of a few days ago. And it was recent grads who have found their way into mental health and they're looking for mentors. And, you know, we go back to the value when we started, actually, of having people who can share their experience and support you as you find your way, hopefully in new territory that welcomes you or they appreciate you.
Yes. Thank you for adding that, Anne. Anybody else want to add anything? I guess that would fall under the, you know, any advice for any of our listeners?
Contact us. You're welcome to join us.
I would like to say it's valuable to supervise students because you don't know what you know until you start to teach it and share it. You learn, they learn. I used to work in a continuing treatment program and I tell students, this is just the beginning. It's like going to a movie. You're only seeing the middle. Well, your career is like a movie and you can write the script. Right. And mental health will welcome you.
Yeah, thank you. I'll
great
put
advice.
It in for that too, Anne, because I started supervising after a year as an occupational therapist, and Emily Raphael was my supervisor. What a rich experience. What a rich experience.
Mm-hmm. Love Emily too.
Yeah, Emily's in our group too. She's a
yes.
Great
yes, and in fact, she's also instrumental in the development of the Project Renewal Program.
Exactly.
Correct?
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. 2 degrees of separation.
Yes. I love it. Yes. Well, ladies, oh my gosh, I don't want to say goodbye. I would like to keep you on for as long as I can. But is there anything else that you'd like to add? I know, you know, your work is so inspiring. You educate, you advocate, you know, now you're elevating other OTs by talking about the various models that are out there.
We get more than we give. I get more than I get from not only, you know, not only the members of the group, but from you right now, from just seeing how wonderful you've become, this great OT here, this wonderful podcaster. I'm so proud of you. We get so much from all of that.
Each other, right?
Yeah, each other.
Yeah, and it's almost like these energies, the energies bounce off of each other.
Yeah, whoa, sometimes the energy gets...
we actually meet weekly, the task force, and so we're actually going to go on to a meeting
right now.
Yeah, we meet weekly, so we welcome anyone that gets on that listserv.
Yeah, and even just to, you know, I don't always respond, but you just see what's going on and it keeps you abreast to, you know, the different job opportunities that are out there. Just, I even like reading the ones where students introduce themselves or soon to graduate students or introduce themselves to the community, right?
And
share
a
little bit.
Right?
Yeah, I love those. I would hire them if I had the opportunity. Right?
Me too.
Yeah,
wish I had it when I was looking for people.
I will pull it. I would just that people should join their national aid organization and support.
Exactly.
That I would say.
Yeah, the local. I think the local is so important for change.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that why you're, you know, I didn't get to ask this earlier, but, you know, you're sort of there. I'm hearing more of a legislative movement or a move towards advocacy. Is that because that's where you really feel change will happen after all these years of practice?
We need to have the change. We need to have the change because with our group growing, we have lots of different people with different skills. And they've been looking at different aspects of our practice act, our scope of practice, all kinds of stuff, and seeing that there are holes.
Yes.
That we have some problems that if we don't fix, it may mean that we can't grow and go into different areas. So it's really very important for us to really work on these aspects and work on them now.
Mm-hmm. I read something recently, I think through an NBCOT publication, about a bill being passed in the Senate. Did any of you hear about that?
Oh,
about
mental health? Yes. I don't know if it's been passed. Has it not yet, right?
I think there has been proposed.
That's the one that Jeff highlighted in one of our emails.
Yeah, Hassan and Tim somebody or other.
Yeah, Senator Hassan, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's exciting.
It is exciting. I hope it passes. I really do. We need to have that pass.
So in terms of advocacy, part of our mission is to really expand recognition for OT and mental health and expand opportunities for funding.
Right.
Yes. And the other part is to really keep OT mental health alive in curriculums and give students solid exposure to fieldwork so they feel grounded to use the mental health perspective in whatever area of practice they find themselves in.
Yes.
Good slogan. Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
I know you ladies, this group has been around for me for, you know, I've been practicing for 22 years now, believe it or not.
Get out!
Yes, I know. Sorry if I'm dating you by sharing that tidbit. But, you know, you've been around for me this whole time. So I feel so fortunate. But again, the reality is that mental health has not always been the most popular subspecialty, right? Yeah. I believe that lately, perhaps with the pandemic, perhaps the need, you know, the obvious need that there is now, it's becoming more of a, I don't want to say trendy, but there's definitely more interest on the, you know, on the parts of students, on the parts of OTs, even, you know, devoting their capstones and research and, you know, in mental health. So I absolutely love it. And, you know, I love that after 22 years, you're still around. You're around.
I
mean that in all the best ways, right? You're still around. And in fact, now you have, I feel like now you have more of a platform. You know, you're more amplified now because there's so many more OTs and OTPs out there listening, right? You've turned something on, right? Something's been activated. So now is the time not to retire, ladies. Now is the time to go into your second, your retirement roles.
These are our retirement roles.
But because of retirement, I think we have the time and the opportunity to do this. This is very time consuming. So that's the beauty. And my dream is that we can, you know, leave the profession knowing we've impacted change to the profession. Yes. Not just to all our students and patients that we've impacted, but to the profession at large. So that doesn't sound grandiose,
Joan, we are getting recognition too. I mean, we have gotten the NYSOTA Merit for Practice, Rita Cottrell has put us in the leaders in the archive of AOTA's archive. So.
That's OT's Leaders in Legacy, which is a sort of heritage OTs who are sharing their gifts to the OT world.
Oh, wow. I can only aspire to be a part of that list one day.
You're getting there.
Incredible. No, so well, but so well deserved. You needed to be on that list many years ago, but I'm glad you finally are. Amazing. I just want to thank you all for your work, for everything that you do, for the time that you devote to elevating our profession, particularly mental health within our profession, for sharing with us today your journey, you know, how you got here, what motivates you to do this type of work, and even sharing just our camaraderie, I think, and our, you know, relationship that's evolved over the years into this. I have a feeling that our listeners are really going to feel that, right? Mm-hmm. So thank you again so much for spending this time with me. And I look forward to hearing the next chapters for all of you.
Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you so much. It's thank been you an so honor much. Spending this hour with you.
And that wraps up another inspiring episode of the Uncommon OT series. Connect with me at www.transitionsot.com. And don't forget to sign up to be part of the Transitions OT community. By doing so, you'll receive my latest compiled list of Uncommon OT practice settings, the latest news on mentoring offerings, Uncommon OT live events, non-traditional OT resources, and more. You may also follow me on my social media pages on Instagram and LinkedIn. And if you love this episode, head on over to Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, and Google Podcasts to follow, rate, and leave a review. I also ask you to consider pledging your support to my passion podcast project by being a patron on Patreon. It is very much appreciated. Sending big OT love. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.